You are listening to WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet Radio Program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world, which deep down is what all of us really want. As our regular listeners know, we often take the opportunity on this show to question social norms. And we feel that's incredibly important to do because if we don't do that on a regular basis, we can fall prey to acting in a way that was passed on to us by previous generations that might have been appropriate back then, but currently really doesn't fit our values. So we like to think of ourselves as living in an upwardly evolving society that's getting kinder and wiser over time, but that evolution doesn't happen if we're sleeping at the wheel and just accepting every single thing that our parents or grandparents handed down to us. And just to give a little bit of color to this so that you understand this, at one point slavery was just okay until we agreed that it wasn't. So I look at our job on this show as partly being the ones to continuously question what is that bizarre practice that everybody still agrees today is okay, but when examined carefully, is just as bizarre and unjust as many of these weird things from the past, like women not being able to vote and slavery. And if you're thinking that there's nothing to match those historical examples of cruelty that we're now more aware and compassionate than that, I can understand thinking that. But I will also strongly disagree, and I can prove it to you with any one of a number of examples, but I'll give you just one. We live on a planet with 8 billion people. We have plenty of food to feed everybody, and yet over 800 million people are chronically hungry because they have no money and no choice. Future generations, I hope, will look at this and the way we're doing things now as being as unacceptable as the things we see in history that we now know are unacceptable. So today's show is about questioning another norm that I'm betting most of you have never thought about. And in this case, the norm is the way a particular institution that so many of us love and rely upon for the care of our family members is involved in practices that don't quite make a whole lot of sense in today's world. That is, veterinarians, and specifically the American Veterinary Medical Association. Now, at this point, many of you should be wondering what on earth I'm talking about. Well, you'll learn that in a moment. And we're fortunate to have with us a perfect person to present this information to you, who is herself a veterinarian. Her name is Dr. Crystal Heath. She's the executive director of Our Honor, a nonprofit that supports veterinary students, veterinarians, and other animal professionals in speaking their conscience to create more ethical systems that consider the best interests of all species. Dr. Heath is a shelter veterinarian, an 11-year member of the American Veterinary Medical Association, and a graduate of the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She was recently named one of Vox's 2023 Future Perfect 50, which honors the scientists, thinkers, scholars, writers, and activists working on solutions to today's and tomorrow's biggest problems. She's also on the founding committee of Veterinarians Against Ventilation Shutdown. Dr. Heath is quoted and featured in numerous articles about animals, including Vox, The Guardian, Intercept, Los Angeles Times, Tablet, and more. She was interviewed on CBS Bay Area very recently. Her opinion pieces and commentary have appeared in the British Veterinary Journal, Veterinary Record, and many more. Dr. Heath, thank you for joining us on the Healthy Planet Radio Show and for all the important work that you've been doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on here.
Dr. Heath, you talk about the need to challenge one's profession or movements in order to make them better. And that is certainly what you've been involved with. And you say that your outspokenness has actually led to the animal agriculture industry's campaign to destroy your reputation. And that that motivated you to found the organization named Our Honor. So give us a sense of the work and goals of Our Honor, and then go back in time and describe how the young Crystal Heath became the current Dr. Crystal Heath, who has taken on a prominent role in challenging the veterinary profession.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to see you say outspoken, because I'm like a very introverted, quiet person. Like in school, I would never raise my hand or anything. And now all of a sudden I've like been pushed out into the forefront as like this person who is speaking truth to power. But really, this all started, I've always been an animal advocate. I've always really loved animals. This is why I went to vet school. But I wasn't always as outspoken as I am now. I kind of started to become more outspoken in 2020. I got more involved in activism online, especially with COVID-19. We are all kind of indoors. And so I started posting things on my social media, my public social media page, more critical of animal agriculture. And around this time, the animal agriculture industry was getting very defensive, because we found out during the slaughterhouse bottleneck of 2020, due to COVID, workers were getting sick. They resorted to using a method of sealing up barns, pumping in heat, and waiting for the animals inside to die as a way to solve this problem of too many animals and not enough slaughterhouse workers to process them. That's when this meme went around about me on the veterinary Facebook groups. This very brightly colored meme that said, "Beware," with my picture on it. Dr. Heath means nothing good for the profession. She's affiliated with the ALF and the ELF, which I was not. I merely, like, the extent of my activism was, you know, I lobbied for the fur ban in California, you know, very professional things, putting words on the internet, writing things. That was the extent of my extremism. And, you know, banning fur in California, not really an extreme thing. I think most people are on board with banning fur.
50 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, the California Veterinary Medical Association wasn't supportive of that bill. I don't think they took a stand on it, but that was really concerning. But yeah, I started being more outspoken about these things. This meme went around about me. I was kicked out of all of these veterinary Facebook groups, and like nobody asked to hear my side of the story. And then my colleagues started reaching out to me saying they had experienced the same thing. They felt that they couldn't express their views about animals for fear of being attacked. We talked about what we'll probably go into is terminal surgeries in veterinary schools, how we learn how to do surgery, which involves killing animals, which many schools are moving away from, thankfully. But they spoke to me about their activism around this. So yeah, I kind of became more outspoken about these things, was banned from a lot of veterinary Facebook groups. And then we discovered this FOIA, Freedom of Information Act document, where the Animal Agriculture Alliance sent out this email about me, saying that I was intending to go undercover and secretly record people to find evidence to use against the industry, which was not true. I was not planning on doing that at all.
They had cooked up a whole imaginary scenario there.
Yes, indeed. And so this was pretty shocking. And I told my journalist friend, who's friends with Glenn Greenwald, and Glenn Greenwald was like, "Wow, what a crazy story." And he wrote this wonderful piece for The Intercept about it. I was on his show, and that kind of launched this organization that I have our honor, and we help support veterinarians and veterinary professionals who face bullying and retaliation for speaking up about these issues. So that's how it all kind of started.
Isn't that something? You never know where you're going to end up.
You never know. Yeah.
In 2019, you wouldn't have thought, right?
Yeah, no, this was completely out of the blue. You never know where life is going to lead you. But yeah, you asked me like what happened, like how I grew up. And I grew up in a really agriculture heavy area, rural area. I was in 4-H, which, if you don't know, it's this government program that is created through the land grant universities to teach children modern agriculture techniques. And so we raised goats and chickens, and I never ended up selling any of my animals to market, but that's a common thing that you see 4-H'ers do, showing their animals at the county fair, selling them to market. I never did any of that. I was vice president of my 4-H club. And then gradually got my hands on some PETA material, became vegetarian, then became vegan, you know, more recently, I've only been strict vegan for probably 6 or 7 years now. And yeah, that's kind of my past and what led me here.
You bring up the 4-H, and I know you're involved with an organization that is giving a humane alternative to 4-H. Now, living on Long Island in the East Coast my whole life, I never knew really what the 4-H was. I thought it was a wholesome organization with kids and animals, but reading some of your materials, some of what they're doing is pretty brutal to the psyche of these children. Describe a little bit of that, how they do this.
You may have heard the story of Cedar the goat. And yes, this was a little girl who was raising this meat goat and grew very attached to Cedar, and then had a change of heart and didn't end up wanting to sell the goat to the fair. And the buyer who ended up buying Cedar was like, okay, fine. That's fine. We don't need to kill your goat. They ended up taking the goat to a sanctuary, but the fair was not too happy with this. They sent police after the goat. The police went on a 500-mile hunt to find the goat and took the goat to slaughter with no due process of law. And even our Attorney General of California got involved and tried to sue the family. And It was just a ridiculous and absurd situation where this little girl had this change of heart, but she was like really punished for it. And that really kind of goes to show the problem with 4-H in general, is it sort of normalizes kids to betray their conscience and ignore this compassion that they have for animals. And I saw this too. I saw it when you're younger, you sell your first animal at the fair and everybody's crying. And then over time, the older kids get really callous about it. They don't even name their animals. They objectify their animals. And there's actually been this paper that was recently published about the psychological impacts of 4-H on kids. And they talk about how they go through these cognitive processes to deal with this. And they learn how to manage their emotions through these techniques. They don't necessarily like stifle or control them, but they sort of change these ideas and thoughts that they have about their animals. And they interviewed kids about this and how they don't name their animals anymore. And it's really, really disturbing, because I think of the quote from Bradley Miller, which is, teaching a child not to step on a caterpillar is as valuable to the child as it is to the caterpillar. And we are going against that quote when we teach these kids this whole process.
Now, it's really hard to believe that that would be going on, and that they would have such an interest in getting that one goat that that girl loved. So it must have been threatening to them. That's the only thing I can imagine, that an example would be threatening.
They're like, yeah, legitimacy overall. Like, we can't have a whole bunch of kids suddenly having a change of heart at the last minute. We have to keep this program. They have to, you know, obey their contract, which they signed a contract. They're not even 18 years old yet. They can't sign a contract, but it's part of this system, or it's like, you signed up for this, you have to follow through, sort of thing. Like, that's more important than having a change of heart and being flexible about these things, because so many kids have this problem. If they let one go by, then the whole thing might crumble. And I've heard so many stories of various moms too, who don't end up feeding the animals as much, or like run the animals around hoping that they won't make weight. Like, that's the big secret behind 4-H. All these moms working behind the scenes to try to make sure that the animals don't make weight for the county fair.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
If they don't make weight, they don't get sold?
Yeah, they don't. They can't be shown at the fair. Like, they know they're either attached to the animal or their kids are attached, and they don't want to have to go through all this. So they really make sure that the animals don't make weight. It's this kind of secret.
Smart. Smart. Yeah. Well, you've got to do what you can do to avoid the worst possible outcome to someone you love. And does that make sense? So we've talked about something on this show that psychologists discuss, and it's called the meat paradox. That paradox is about how people can really love animals, like those little girls with their 4-H animals, and at the same time, happily eat animals, even though doing so is entirely unnecessary for their health, for their survival, for anything. And that same paradox is, to me, even more paradoxical when it comes to veterinarians, since their whole lives are in theory devoted to the welfare of their patients, who are the animals. And yet some of them work with and enable industries that are devoted to using and killing animals solely for profit. And I say that again, since again, we know now that there's no need in human nutrition for eating them or killing them. You say that this disconnect comes from the top and it permeates through the entire profession, from veterinary schools to the profession itself. So give us a glimpse of how veterinary students are surprisingly desensitized to, and how they're forced, as you mentioned before, into harming animals. And if you would, mention an example. I know that I saw you talking about one from a book by Bernard Rollins. If you feel it appropriate, bring that up as well.
Yeah, it's this problem in medical education in general, that doctors, medical students become less empathetic as they transition through medical training. And it's a process because we have to do a lot of things to people and to animals that causes pain. And there is this brilliant essay that was recently written, Dr. Colaini, called The Long Shadow. And she discusses how in Nazi Germany, how the doctors sort of rationalize it. And throughout history, just talking about all of the things that doctors have done throughout history, Guantanamo Bay, Hurricane Katrina, the Mercy Killings. She talks about how medical students are forced to practice pelvic exams on anesthetized women, all of these unethical things that doctors took pardon, and how she might shield herself from participating in all of this. And she talks about how during World War II, 7% of doctors became members of the SS and why that is. And she talks about how we use euphemisms to, you know, instead of saying we killed them, we euthanize them, we sacrifice them, all of these words that we use to kind of distance ourselves from what's actually going on. And the human medical profession is really dealing with this whole lack of empathy problem and grappling with it. There, you can't have empathy for every patient that you have, or else you just won't be able to do your job. You can't just fall apart after everything that you see. But how can we also maintain some of our humanity while we're learning all of these things? The veterinary profession is not really grappling with this well. One of the things that we do, like when we practice surgery, we often do things called terminal surgeries, where we actually kill the animal that we're practicing on. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bernard Rollin, he's an ethicist at Colorado State University. He talks about how when he was starting out a few years ago, he actually met a professor who would anesthetize animals multiple times and have students practice multiple surgeries on them before killing them. And one such student beat on their dog with a sledgehammer and spent the semester repairing the damage. And he talks about how that student received an A. Mm. Now, that's not really done anymore, but many schools still require students to practice surgery on an animal and then kill the animal afterwards. That's viewed as more humane than repeated surgeries on one animal. Of course, I never had to do this in veterinary school. I learned at UC Davis. UC Davis still does terminal surgeries on livestock. It's an elective course that you can take, but I chose not to take that course. We took a community surgery course where we learned on animals who needed surgery under the guidance of experienced surgeons. Now surgery is my favorite part of practice. I love surgery and I teach surgery to other students, and we learn on animals who need surgery and I teach them on animals who need surgery. So many veterinarians have been speaking out about this and trying to change systems, but students still face failing grades and bullying and retaliation for voicing concerns, for being that one student in the class who's like, wait, this whole curriculum is very unethical. This goes against our oath. I know a student who received an F for being a conscientious objector. Mm. In the United States, like, she should be able to be a conscientious objector without suffering any consequences for that. So it's really ridiculous. And it's really ridiculous that any school is still doing terminal surgeries at all, because we have so many better ways of teaching surgery. And we have so many animals who need surgery that students can learn on under the guidance of experienced surgeons after they practice on models and all of these other things. So it's really disturbing how the veterinary profession isn't really advancing and progressing. And that's, I think, has a lot to do with because we want to train veterinarians who are willing to go along with the animal agriculture industry. Because the more that we have a shortage of veterinarians who are willing and able to go into livestock medicine. And part of that is due to the number of women that we have in our profession now. There's a rapid growth in the number of women, and they are pointing to the fact that women are more animal rights friendly. We're less likely to view animals as beings that can be exploited and harmed. And I think we're more willing to push back on some of these unethical things and demand changes. They don't like that. So now they're even talking about not admitting as many women in the veterinary profession so that hopefully we can find more food animal veterinarians, people willing to do food animal medicine and make up this need that we have for food animal veterinarians. Instead of maybe we should be working towards decreasing the number of animals that need food animal veterinarians, we should be moving away from the slaughter-based model of protein production and more towards slaughter-free.
Right.
But that would affect a lot of industries. It would affect the pharmaceutical industry, who profits off of selling medications and vaccines to slaughter-bound animals. It would affect the feed crop industry that profits from selling feed crops to animals. So many industries would be affected if we decreased the number of animals that needed to be slaughtered. So there's a lot of interest in perpetuating the status quo and even growing the number of animals that we slaughter every year.
Isn't it amazing that women bring a quality to the organization, to the profession, that is sorely needed and incredibly valuable? And the response from those who are entrenched in the old ways is to squash it.
Yeah.
Even when it goes against the very reason for the existence of veterinarians, which is to help animals. It's kind of mind-boggling.
And public health, that's in our oath too. We're supposed to prevent animal suffering and promote public health. We know animal agriculture threatens public health. So why are we continuing to,
to
promote it against our own oath?
This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Dr. Crystal Heath, the Executive Director of Our Honor, a nonprofit that supports veterinary students, veterinarians, and other animal professionals in speaking their conscience to create more ethical systems that consider the best interests of all species. You can find out more about Dr. Heath and Our Honor at www.ourhonor.org. That's Our, O-U-R, Honor, H-O-N-O-R, .org. We started talking about the AVMA, so I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more about them. That's the American Veterinary Medical Association. Talk about their function and what you call their corporate bias, which you mentioned a bit.
Yeah, so the AVMA, they are the largest veterinary organization in the United States. They have 100,000 members. There's 125,000 veterinarians in the United States, so we're not all members of the AVMA, but the vast majority of us are, including me. And because I am a member because hopefully it gives me a voice to change things, although that's been really hard to come by recently. And they also... they have the AVMA Council on Education, which accredits DVM programs. They lobby the government. They have this PAC, and they lobby for legislation that they want. They also set a lot of policy related to the United States Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. So things like avian influenza, they have their guidelines for the depopulation of animals. So when we need to kill a bunch of birds because of an outbreak of avian influenza like that we have, the USDA looks to the AVMA's guidelines to set policy on that, and also bailouts for producers who kill their animals according to the AVMA guidelines. Mm-hmm. But who are the AVMA sponsors? It's pharmaceutical companies, animal agriculture corporations. And this creates a problem. And it's also a problem because the vast majority of veterinarians are dog and cat veterinarians, 60% or more. Only about 5% of AVMA membership is our animal agriculture veterinarians, livestock veterinarians, but they have a large microphone. There's various committees at the AVMA, and there's all these seats for people who work in animal agriculture. And maybe there's like one seat for like your dog and cat veterinarian, but there's like, you know, the public health veterinarians, the ruminant veterinarians, the bovine veterinarians, the swine veterinarians. They all, there's so many seats that they get that in the industry veterinarians that, and there's only like one for dog and cat vets. So
isn't that something?
And there's no like animal protection veterinarians. We don't have a voice at all. Like we've been ostracized. I've tried to apply for various committees. I even, you know, we started, well, we can go into avian flu a little bit more later, but sure. Yeah, they wield a lot of influence and they seem to be insistent on promoting the interests of their stakeholders, which are these pharmaceutical companies and animal agriculture companies, really against their mission. And I think a lot of veterinarians are not aware that this is their kind of secret agenda.
Yeah. And if I may say, when I see what you've done in a few years and how you're starting to get people not to change overnight, because that never happens, but you're getting it on the agenda, whether it's in the background or directly, people are starting to hear about the fact that, and all of those veterinarians who are like you, and I'm sure there are many of them, because look, they went into a field where they're helping animals. So mm-hmm. I see your success going forward as very bright. So you, I know
so.
You say that there's been resistance, but it's clear as day to me.
Well, I'm encouraged. Thank you.
Yeah, good, good. I've been doing this since 1990. And oh, wow. Back at that time, the world was not the way it is today. It has changed significantly. And you've only been doing this a short period of time. And your message is powerful and it's very consistent with the values of the people who are listening to you. So it's a shoo-in.
Awesome.
Now, on the other hand, the AVMA, they have a principle of veterinary ethics, or they have principles of veterinary mm-hmm. ethics, which, I mean, the very first one to me is oxymoronic. It's the principle is, and I quote, "A veterinarian shall be influenced only by the welfare of the patient," that's the animal, "the needs of the client, the safety of the public, and the need to uphold the public trust vested in the veterinary profession," end quote. Now, how can you have a principle that says you're only influenced by the welfare of the animal, and yet you're also influenced by the needs of clients? And in this case, it could be clients who have devoted all of their time, energy, and money toward raising animals to kill them, all in the interest of profit, not for the animals at all. So how do those two things go hand in hand with an organization that is veterinary professionals?
Well, I can tell you how it plays out in real life.
Yeah.
Well, one example, so I've been doing a lot of advocacy about ventilation shutdown. This is the method that has been gaining in popularity or prominence or frequency, I guess you should say.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, because of the avian influenza outbreak, 82 million birds have been killed in this country since 2022. And this started, you know, gaining public attention back in 2020 with COVID-19. And this was a method used to kill pigs during that time, which is just horrifying.
It's brutal.
And we thought, oh my gosh, the AVMA has this as a method to be used in constrained circumstances. This isn't a constrained circumstance. This isn't an infectious disease outbreak, COVID-19. Like they're just doing this because they ran out of space for these pigs. They really need to put plans in place to use better methods. The veterinary profession should not be legitimizing sealing up barns and pumping in heat and waiting for animals to die. Like there's no way the veterinary profession should be behind this. And so now we've gotten more than 2,000 veterinarians to sign on to this. We submitted two petitions to the AVMA House of Delegates going through their normal system. the first petition they voted on, and then they pushed that question back to the panel on depopulation. And the panel on depopulation, we're told, only reviews their guidelines every 10 years, but they were going to meet in the interim after they looked at the guidelines on humane slaughter, and these did some other work. So now it's three years later, still haven't addressed it. And there's still no new draft out. So we submitted a petition in the interim, and we're like, hey, in the interim, while you guys are discussing this, can we reclassify it as not recommended? They denied our petition altogether. They even changed their House of Delegates manual to make sure petitions like ours couldn't go forward again. They also increased the number of veterinarians needed to submit a petition. It used to be 50, and now it's 200.
Oh my goodness.
All because of us.
You're making a difference already, see?
I know, some kind of difference, not the difference that I wanted to make.
Well, resistance is the first response.
Yeah.
And that's what you're getting.
That's what we're getting. And we also wanted to attend the Humane Ending Symposium, because this is where people and researchers were going to talk about this. And we wanted to hear what was going on. A bunch of us who had been advocating against ventilation shutdown were rejected, were denied entrance to the Humane Ending Symposium. And this, I'm an 11-year member of the AVMA, 12-year, going on 12 years now, in good standing. The media asked them, like, why did you reject these veterinarians? And they said, their leadership said to the media that implied that we would create an unsafe space, and producers needed a safe space to discuss these issues. So pretty defamatory-ish, like, we're just quiet lady veterinarians who like a seat at the table. Like, what have we done that's so threatening? So we don't understand, like, and
disturbing
can
the
you
order.
Give us feedback on how we can create a safe space rather than just reject us altogether? I was also rejected from the AVMA legislative fly-in, which should be a member benefit. And they sent me this really snarky email that was unsigned and so unprofessional, saying, this doesn't have anything to do with the issues you care so passionately about. And it's like, wow. So I just, publish all these things, let the media know, and hopefully get the word out there that these
letting
people
the light
are
in,
not
huh?
really what they appear to be. This is incredibly unprofessional.
Wow, that's amazing. And talk about euphemisms, depopulation. Isn't it interesting that you can leave your dog in the car, and that people would be aghast if they hear about stories like this. And if that dog dies of heat stroke, you could go to jail for several years. You could pay tens of thousands of dollars in fines. And yet when millions of pigs, birds, and other animals that we're raising for no need, it's unnecessarily, they're killed in the same way, nobody blinks an eye.
The AVMA legitimizes this. So now producers get millions of dollars in bailout money when their animals are killed this way. Yeah. So more than $1 billion has gone, taxpayer money has gone to deal with the avian influenza outbreak. Jennie-O Turkey Store, who Biden pardoned those two turkeys from Jennie-O Turkey Store. It was a giant media campaign for Jennie-O. They used ventilation shutdown on their turkeys. They got $85 million in bailout money. Tyson got $29 million, while their CEO took home $13 million. This is just ridiculous. And if the veterinarians didn't say that this was okay, they, in theory, wouldn't get the bailout money.
So obviously there's no good way to slaughter an animal against its will. So am I correct in assuming that the eventual ideal solution you'd be proposing for veterinarians is to start speaking out against the existence of the slaughter-based industry? Not that that would happen now, but is that something that would be a goal?
I think we need to start promoting slaughter-free farmers and slaughter-free producers. And that starts with, every veterinary conference should have slaughter-free food, and this is our future. We should be transitioning to slaughter-free forms of protein production. We're not talking about even weird cultivated meat stuff, which is, it shouldn't be banned. Like that should be a thing, but food that we already love and enjoy and we know is healthy, like beans, we need to help promote increased consumption of beans. Just reduce the amount of animal slaughter-based protein that we have in our diets. I, you know, I'm a healthy vegan, as you are too. And so I know that this is a healthy diet, but it's really hard for people right now because the slaughter industry makes it really hard. They've drastically changed our diets. In the 1960s, we used to eat only 50 pounds of meat per year. And now we eat well over 200 pounds per year. Like that's a drastic change in our diets in a very short period of time. So I think we can change our diets to slaughter-free nutrients, you know, as quickly, if not faster. And I think the planet would be healthier. Our animals would be healthier, less avian influenza outbreaks everywhere. So it'd be better for everybody.
It sure would be. And the inappropriate food choices at conferences such as that, I've seen the parallel inappropriate food choice at environmental meetings where they're serving meat and cold cuts. Like, wait a minute. It's an environmental meeting. You shouldn't be contradicting your values with the food you're serving, especially when there's plenty of other food available. That's, and fortunately, I've seen that changed with some great organizations on Long Island, but it's still being done. And how that disconnect can exist in the case of veterinarians or environmental organizations is a little bit mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and our profession particularly is 93.3% white. And is that very welcoming to people from other traditions, Buddhists, other people from other countries coming into the veterinary profession and seeing all of this meat that maybe they don't want to eat? Many people are lactose intolerant throughout the world. So let's just have food available that suits everybody's dietary habits and everybody's cultural background and everybody's dietary tolerances, which is a slaughter-free diet. Nobody's against beans, and we can have a variety of different fruits and vegetables and tofu and all of these things and nuts that everybody can eat. But when we stick to just a few things like meat and cheese and eggs, like that really limits who can come to our table.
It certainly does. And for no good reason. Again, now there's a voice speaking out, and that's the first step toward it changing. Got to be on the agenda first. You mentioned the zoonotic diseases. Would you go a little bit more into that in terms of how they're manifesting, how serious they are, how much they've influenced human disease throughout the past 100 years? Because I think we've talked about it on the show, but I think it's pretty much unknown to the general population, the level to which animals and raising of animals contributes to human disease.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 75% of new emerging diseases come from animals. And in veterinary school at UC Davis, UC Davis is doing a ton of work on this. Ironically, they're both very animal agriculture, a lot of animal research, but they're also doing really great work with One Health. And One Health is the idea that human, animal, environmental, plant health is all interconnected. And as we have increased and encroached onto wildlife, we have increased the number of diseases. We've increased the number of viruses throughout the years. There's graphs and charts showing this. We're seeing new novel diseases. And also animal agriculture uses a large number of antibiotics that are human relevant antibiotics, despite what the industry wants to tell you. They are human relevant antibiotics, and that's creating a lot of antibiotic resistance, which poses a huge threat. So now we're also seeing increased numbers of antibiotic resistant pathogens as well. And we've seen avian influenza, like this outbreak of avian influenza is so much worse than anything that we've seen previously. In 2015 was the last one, but this year's outbreak just is unprecedented, blows away everything else. And now it's also affecting different mammals, skunks, a polar bear, elephant seals in Argentina. 96% of the elephant seal pups born in 2023 died from highly pathogenic avian influenza. Mink farms, and they're also finding that this virus infects mammals and then goes back and infects birds, this creates the perfect environment to where it can mutate and eventually jump and spread to humans. And when you have an environment like a factory farm, where you have thousands of genetically similar animals housed together in close contact with humans, you are creating the perfect environment for that virus to jump from animal to animal and then into humans. And humans share similar receptors for avian and for influenza viruses, as do pigs. So poultry and pigs and humans together create the perfect environment for an influenza virus of pandemic potential to spread. And now, finally, the CDC even recently updated their influenza document saying, yes, the way that it is now mutated to affect multiple species of mammals, it poses a threat to humans as well.
It does indeed. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Dr. Crystal Heath, the executive director of Our Honor, a nonprofit that supports veterinary students, veterinarians, and other animal professionals in speaking their conscience to create more ethical systems that consider the best interests of all species. You can find out more about Dr. Heath and Our Honor at www.ourhonor.org. That's Our, O-U-R, Honor, H-O-N-O-R, .org. I saw that Our Honor obtained documents from the pork industry that were said to take a page out of the fossil fuel and tobacco industry playbook in creating what they call the Real Pork Trust and Image Thought Leadership Program. Describe that. Yeah. It's pretty weird, but understandable that it would come out in this climate where they need to think about these things.
Yeah. If you're not following this whole thing, there's the UC Davis Clear Center, Frank Mitlohner, very similar program. It's this pseudoscientific sort of program, but really it was a giant PR campaign funded by the animal agriculture industry. And the industry has basically discovered that their company people are better suited sitting in these faculty positions than they are actually sitting in the companies themselves, because the universities, these research universities, institutions give this air of legitimacy to the things that they're saying. And the pork industry is like, you know, we need to get on board with this. We need to help promote consumer trust. Right now, there's a lot of distrust about the pork industry, you know, the whole confining pigs in gestation crates, killing them with ventilation shutdown, the way that we kill them with gas chambers, which is a newish thing that we're doing now to increase the number of pigs that are killed. Video footage has been leaked out to the public, and people are seeing how horrifying it is for pigs to die in these carbon dioxide gas chambers. And that's how we kill the vast majority of pigs in the United States. 113 million pigs every year are killed in these carbon dioxide gas chambers. So they need to make the public feel a little bit better about all of this so that they continue to increase their pork consumption. And so they've funded, the National Pork Board has funded this $8 million program, and five different universities are involved: Iowa State, North Carolina State University, Minnesota, Georgia, and they're going to research into what they can do, what questions that they can ask to help build consumer trust, you know. And they're making some statements about, oh, we can improve pig welfare or things like that. But really, this is giving giant PR campaign. So we're going to be doing a lot more promoting of this story, getting this out to the media and sharing this with the world, because I think people want to know that their university research institution should be non-biased, and they should be really promoting the best interests of the public, not corporate interests, which ultimately threaten public health and the health of animals and the welfare of animals too.
Right. When you put all those things together, it's obvious what direction they need to go in. But of course, any industry or any company that's doing anything will pretty much hold on to what it's doing as long as they possibly can, until they see that it's no longer workable, that public opinion has changed. And I, you know, we're obviously a long way away from overall public opinion moving totally away from eating animals. But with the advent of plant-based meats, I think we're closer, a lot closer than we were just 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're, as I've mentioned, a force to be reckoned with. And I'd like for you to talk about some of the positives you've seen come from the work that you've been doing with Our Honor and other organizations and yourself.
One thing I think the animal protection movement in general was lacking was legitimacy. And they didn't have veterinarians who would say, yes, like your footage that you captured is valid. Journalists would often seek out veterinarians to get their take on this animal rights footage that was just released, this factory farm investigation. And veterinarians would say, oh, this is animal rights propaganda. This is highly doctored footage. And we say, like, we look at the footage. I have often told animal protection groups, you need to do a better job at getting footage. You need to get longer shots so that we know that it's not doctored and do it in a way that clearly shows what's going on. I am really thankful for Raven Deerbrook is one activist who got 16 hours of footage of a slaughterhouse gas chamber, just nonstop, just kept it rolling and sent that footage to us. And this, like, this is fantastic. And even got Temple Grandin to look at it and give quotes to the media about this, you know, saying this is horrifying. The pigs are suffering. Dr. Jim Reynolds, who's a livestock medicine professor at Western University, looked at the footage too and gave quotes to the media. We drafted a long statement saying, yes, this is legitimate. This isn't animal rights propaganda. This is real. This is how these pigs are killed. And now a bunch of people are talking about it. And we're talking about how, what can we do here to address this? And so I think getting that media attention out there is huge. And we've been able to get a lot of media attention with very minimal resources. Like, we're not a giant organization. We're not HSUS. We're not the ASPCA. Right. You know, we have a very tiny budget and very small group. Like, I do most of the work myself. And then we have a small team of contractors that I pay, you know. So it's a very small team, and we're getting a lot of attention with just the minimum resources that we have. So that's been really positive.
By the way, I love your team on the website. I was reading what they wrote and how they got to be where they are. And it's amazing. You pulled together a really good group of people.
Yeah, our board is all women and all vegans. And we have one non-veterinarian who, like, keeps us grounded. But yeah, all veterinarians besides that.
All right, good. Anything else you'd like to add in terms of things that you've been working on?
Well, if you've been looking at the news recently, you'll see Miami Seaquarium.
Yes.
This story is just in line with everything that we do. It's people who love animals, got into this, working for this company, and then realized, oh no, this company was not out for the best interests of the animals. And they realized people who voiced concerns about the treatment of the animals ultimately were fired, bullied, kicked out, which is what happens in the veterinary profession, which we need to address. And so we're raising awareness about this. Veterinarians and staff reported that the company wasn't paying their diagnostic fees. They weren't giving the animals the care they need. They weren't hiring enough staff. And they were promoting the people who were loyal to the company and who accepted the status quo. So now the mayor has issued a notice to evict the dolphin company from Miami Seaquarium. And now we're watching very closely. The dolphin company is resisting. They are hired a bunch of attorneys. So they have way more attorneys than veterinarians, which says a lot. It says where their priorities are. But I think the end is near for Miami Seaquarium, but we just have to make sure the animals go to better places and are protected.
That's great. You've been in the news. And as I mentioned, you were on CBS in that area, talking about all of this and making an impact. So congratulations. I know it's not done yet, but just raising the issue and speaking on behalf of the animals. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for having me on and giving me more platform.
Yeah, that's what we do. So if veterinarians are one day able to, as you say, work for the best interests of all species without fear of retaliation, tell us about the impact that you think that would have on everything from food security to public health, to the environment. And we only have 3 minutes left.
Well, imagine if you, every veterinary office you went to was promoting slaughter-free food consumption, slaughter-free food production. We were lobbying government for animal protection. We were supporting all of those bills that the AVMA and state VMAs currently fight against. Things like declaw bans, things like gestation crates, castration without anesthesia, gas chambers, ventilation shutdown. We would end all of these cruel practices immediately. And we would redirect public funding away from slaughter-based forms of nutrient production towards slaughter-free forms of nutrient production. Those incentives to now produce food using slaughter-free methods, Tyson would be on board, Cargill, Smithfield, JBS, all of these companies would be like, okay, so how can we start building more factories instead of slaughterhouses, more factories and systems to build and produce slaughter-free forms of protein and other nutrients. That's where we see the veterinary profession going. And I just imagine every veterinary office promoting these ideas and people now getting this information from people that they trust, who they feel they know animals, I trust them with my family members. And I think that would change things really rapidly. So I think veterinarians are where we need to put our focus on to advance where we need to be as far as food production and treatment of animals.
Yep, great. Anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
Follow me if you are aligned with us, rhonor.org, and I'm on Twitter. rhonorvets is our handle, but I'm also on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook individually, Dr. Crystal Heath. So follow me there if you want to keep up with our work. We're coming out with new stuff daily. Feel free to reach out too if you have any questions or want to get involved. We also need volunteers. So anybody who wants to volunteer for us, we are accepting people because I can't do it all alone.
And that would be via ourhonor.org?
Yeah, ourhonor.org. You can also email me at info@ourhonor.org or DM me on social media.
Repeat that last one.
Just direct message me on social media, but info@ourhonor.org is the email address.
Okay, info@ourhonor.org.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Crystal Heath, thank you so much for the work and for taking this time for enlightening all of us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We've been talking to Dr. Crystal Heath, the executive director of Our Honor, a nonprofit that supports veterinary students, veterinarians, and other animal professionals in speaking their conscience to create more ethical systems that consider the best interests of all species. And that's what all of us really want. We love our animals. We love our animals like family. And so this is good news that this is happening, that this is starting to create some waves where it should be. You can find out more about Dr. Heath at ourhonor.org, ourhonor.org. In addition to the great work that Our Honor and Dr. Crystal Heath are taking on, I'd like to mention something about the way she communicates her message. Toward the end of most of my talks, after I've told people all the bad news about the world hunger that's very related to the food choices that we're making, to the billions of land animals and trillions of sea life that are killed every year because we demand them, the devastation of the rainforest and the loss of biodiversity, the cancer and the heart disease that's related to diet, and all of these horrible things, I always ask, and I'm giving the punchline away to my talks now, I always ask the audience, now, do you know what happens if you go home tomorrow and you don't change the way you eat? Do you know what that makes you? And of course, my tone implies that I'm about to come out with something that's very judgmental, accusatory, when in fact I say, it makes you human. It makes you human because humans are made in all different shapes and sizes, and we all have different life experiences, and we all have different family dynamics, and social circles, and we're exposed to entirely different stimuli throughout our lives. And so therefore, you're going to handle new information differently than the person next to you or the person next to them. It's important to recognize that because we all change at our own rate. And I'm telling you all this because in watching one of Dr. Heath's lectures, she had very much the same message, stated a little bit differently, but very much the same message about the fact that what we're saying isn't good and you're bad if you're not on the same page at this very moment in time. So she does approach this from a non-judgmental point of view, which I believe is a very effective way to communicate a difficult message. And again, as I've expressed during the show, it's such a pleasure to see this movement taking off because having veterinarians who are the medical professionals for animals speak up on behalf of all the rest of us who feel that they need protection is a very important link in the chain of building something that can reach people in high positions. And finally, I'll commend all of you who stayed with the show this long. I know some parts of it are unpleasant, hearing about the way that animals such as dogs are treated in veterinary schools or the way pigs, who are intelligent, wonderful, feeling creatures, are killed by the millions in gas chambers every year. It's hard to take. But listening to this and hearing this is the first step toward being part of the solution. As unpleasant as it is, if you do not bear witness to what's going on, you're not going to be able to spread what you feel about it. You, being the person who hears it and talks to other people about it, are the person that I talked about at the beginning of this show that helps our society to not be stagnant and satisfied with everything that happened to be handed down to us by our predecessors. So when we come across something that's no longer appropriate for our society or no longer matching our values, you are a necessary part of the equation to bring us to a higher place in years to come. And that'll do it for this evening's show. Join us again on the first and third Fridays of each month at 6 p.m. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to the Natural Alternatives lineup with great hosts from Eugene Zamperone to Beth Fateni, Courtney Bozick, John Scardina, sharing cutting-edge information on health, our environment, social justice issues, and so much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. And for more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And of course, like our Facebook page, which is Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right and to continue to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four and multi-legged friends. And finally, remember to enjoy every moment that we share on this beautiful planet. Good night.
Stand in the end, you'll still be you. One that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand. There's a cross for you to bear. Things to go through if you're going anywhere. Stand. All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal. Stand.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You
hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.